IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. My name is Rohan Seth. I work at the Takshashila Institution as someone who looks at tech policy. I have with me Anupam, who is our in-house economist at Takshashila and one of my favorite people at the office. Today, we're going to talk about a very interesting piece of regulation that came out. It's a bunch of new guidelines regarding cab aggregators that the government has come out with. If I'm not wrong, they came out earlier this week, and they cover a range of stuff which I thought was good. Some of it was bad and some of it was unnecessary. And I'll talk about a few things, Anupam, and you tell me where I've got this wrong, okay? So a couple of good things that I thought were, you know, very welcome in my eyes in this new piece of guidelines. The first one was they recommended the option for female passengers to pool with only female passengers. I think this is a pretty incredible safety option to have, and something so simple that should have always been there in the first place, considering how unsafe some of these cab aggregator services can be. And then there was also this thing called a zero tolerance policy for drugs and alcohol for drivers, which I thought was a pretty good idea, because generally you don't want your driver being either on drugs or high on alcohol when he's driving. And so that bit made me feel safer for when I use Uber or Ola next, which might be a while because of this lockdown. But what do you agree with me over here?
Yeah, so I think that's you got it spot on. Both are good ideas, though I will, you know, talk about the second one later. But the fact that women passengers looking for pooled service will have the option of having only other, you know, female passengers as co-passengers, I think is a good, very good idea. It's, I mean, simple enough feature. Now, it might seem as though the government is overreaching here and trying to suggest features within an app that's already working. But this is not just, you know, about improving user experience, and not just about that. It definitely does that, but it's not just about improving user experience. But I think there's a safety feature. And since, you know, in some sense, the government is responsible for law and order and safety, and this will increase that, I think it's a no-brainer to incorporate this. Now, there is a trade-off, right? There is a trade-off that I think every passenger will face. I mean, women passengers will face, which is that if you opt in for this, and it should be an opt-in, it should be an option available. So if you opt in for this, the chances are that you might have to wait longer for your particular cab, such that, you know, the matching obviously will take longer, or you might have to end up paying more, which is that in a case where, let's say, there is no other female passengers, then you might have to just travel solo, right? So you'll end up paying more. But in any case, I think that option is good to have. And then now, you know, essentially women have the agency to choose which way they want it. So, you know, probably peak hours, 12 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going from one known destination to another known destination. You might not want to opt in for this, right? You want a cab as quick as possible. You think it's safe enough, and that's good enough, right? But let's say it's in the evening, you know, you're going to a place which is probably, you know, takes deserted routes along the way, etc. Then you might want to choose this particular option. So I think the option is good to have, and this is a good move. In terms of the second one, which is on zero tolerance policy for drugs and alcohol, I would actually say it's a good idea, but it is unnecessary because it's not a Uber Ola specific policy, right? Because it's applicable to every single driver on the road. It's not that, you know, me as a normal driver can drink or do drugs and drive, right? So there are very harsh penalties with relation to those transgressions, and that should apply to everyone, whether you are, I mean, you can have an overall, probably a policy, harsher penalties for commercial drivers, whether it's Uber, Ola, other taxis, commercial lorries, etc. Because I think the possible impact is more because it's not just you as a driver, but the passenger. So you can have that, but I don't think it's necessary to have one specific for cab aggregators, right? So you can have penalties for let's say, normal drivers. And that is also zero tolerance, by the way. And then you can have, you know, slightly harsher penalties for all forms of commercial vehicles, whether it's, as I said, it could be one for trucks and lorries, or it could be one for taxis in general. But I don't see the necessity of having a specific kind of zero tolerance policy for Uber and Ola.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I really like the idea about the opt-in, opt-out function based on what time of day it is. I think that's just a smarter way to do choice architecture, I imagine.
Yeah.
I also want to actually talk about a couple of things that I part of me feels like they're unnecessary. So like there's a clause in the
before that, I want to mention one more aspect which I thought was good. And again, so I will say this and you might think it's unnecessary or bad. So I think let's go down that route. Having a fixed number of hours in a day. Now, most of them might think of this as bad or unnecessary, but I think there have been a lot of problems with drivers working for far too many hours in order to, you know, chase that incentive structure. The way Uber and Ola designs their incentive is that you have to do X number of rides in X number of days. So typically it's something like 40, between 40 and let's say 50 rides in 4 days, right? And so you might not always get these rides very quickly. So you might have to do longer hours, which means you have to compromise on either your rest, food or sleep, etc. And we've seen, you know, drivers driving at odd hours of day without proper sleep and therefore getting into accidents. So I think the part about mandating that you can't do more than, I mean, they fixed 12 hours and you can, you know, choose whether 12 hours is a good enough thing or whether 14 hours or 15 hours. I mean, that's up for debate. But I think having X number of hours as maximum number of hours that you can, you know, work is probably a good move. I mean, it's surprising. I mean, I myself, I'm surprised that it's coming from me. It probably seems like overregulation, but I think given our experience on this front in the last 5-6 years of these cabs in operations, it's probably a good idea, right? So capping, and this need not be 12 hours in at a stretch, right? So you can have a driver doing 7 hours in a day, taking 5 hours off, sleeping or 6 hours off. All of that is left to the driver. They should have the freedom, but I don't think it's healthy for any person to be driving and actually live for more than, let's say, 14, 15 hours. So 12 probably is too less. We can debate that as to what is the correct number. But I would say, yeah, something on these lines are actually good. What they have said is actually the other part, and this is an addendum to the same rule, which is to say that, you know, they've said that there has to be a mandatory 10-hour break after working for 12 hours. Now, this I would say is unnecessary because now you're taking agency away. That means you typically work for, I mean, the way they're envisaging it is that the driver works for 12 hours continuously, then a 10 hours break and then 12 hours again, etc. But I think that freedom should be given to the drivers, right? So as long as you say no more than 12 hours in a 24 or 14 hours in a 24 hour period, then the driver works out how they want to break that, right? As I said, they would probably decide to have a 5-hour rest period instead of a 10-hour rest period. That's up to the driver. Let them decide that based on their own conditions and thing. But so I think that part is unnecessary. But having some sort of regulation on how much a person can work is good. Now, this is more or less akin to, you know, labor regulations, right? As to how long and how what should be the maximum kind of number of working hours in a particular company. Now, typically, as I'm against, let's say, the government deciding how much I should work as an economist in front of my laptop, because it really shouldn't matter too much. There's no safety problems, right? But a worker in a factory setting, there are immediate safety repercussions if the person is not very alert, and that happens, right? The worst that can happen is you and I would probably write a bad op-ed or make errors while doing a podcast, which is not really a big deal. But if the driver is not alert, or if you're working in a factory and you're not alert, that can have serious safety repercussions, not just for that person, but for others in surrounding that person as well. So therefore, I think that might be something which is I would be tempted to categorize in the good aspect of it. What's your take on that, Rohan?
So, like, firstly, can I just say that anyone who reads my column, there are no bad op-eds, only good ones. secondly, I think part of me agrees with you, which is that, yes, this is good. You need to have a break of 10 hours after every 12-hour shifts or whatever X number you can plug in. But the reason I categorize this as unnecessary is because I need to see some data that justifies this. So, for example, let's say a break of 10 hours after 12-hour shifts makes sense because you might be having accidents. But is there any data on how many accidents that we've been having that leads us to come to this very specific number for this? Because the thing is, these numbers will actually define the lives of hundreds of thousands of drivers. They'll need to adapt their incentive structure accordingly. And because it's not like the US, where I imagine India people, drivers who drive as a part-time job. Maybe there are just drivers in India, a great number of drivers in India, who do this as a full-time job with no other income to fall back on.
You're right on that.
Yeah, so I would like to see some numbers onto why these exact number of hours have been chosen and the number of accidents that have been happening because of lack of sleep deprivation. Maybe these numbers are justifiable, in which case I agree with them. But as of right now, because I don't see these numbers, to me, it seems a tad bit unnecessary to at least go with this particular incentive structure.
Yeah. So do we need data on this? Absolutely, yes. Do we need evidence-based policymaking? Absolutely, yes, again. But does the logic fit? I would say yes there again. The fact that if you're chasing incentives and you're trying to work 18 hours and trying to drive 18 hours a day, the chances of, purely logically speaking, the chances of or the probability of accidents are higher. I think that holds out. So I would still be in favor of giving a lot more agency to the driver, saying, yeah, no more than X hours in a 24-hour period. They decide how much break they want, when they want it, etc. But if you fix that kind of a limit, perhaps it could work in their favor. But yeah, probably this requires further deliberation. Let's go to your unnecessary list. Others.
This was my first point. My second point, I think... you'll probably want to close your laptop once you hear this. It's the thing has a localization clause, a data localization clause. For no particular reason, they just put it there. And they want access to, once data is localized, they want state governments to have access to it. And so I imagine this comes under non-personal data. And then for personal data, they want people to ask for consent. So I just feel like there's a data protection law that's supposed to come out a lot sooner. It will cover the personal data aspect of it. But the non-personal data, I imagine this is not enough. I don't see what the problem statement is here, why a localization clause is necessary and how it's going to change things. Because I don't think this is a security risk. If it is, it has to be justified in some sense. To me, I don't see why this is necessary to be in these guidelines. It just makes no sense to me.
You are the data localization expert, so I will defer it to your expertise. But yeah, prima facie, I would say it's unnecessary as well. So there's a rare occasion that we agree.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are better, more comprehensive platforms and policies that can be used to regulate this space. Because I don't see the problem statement, and this could have been done better. But it's there, so it's there. What can you do?
Yeah. Right.
And then this one I've been saving for, I guess... towards the meat of the podcast. To me, it seems unnecessary, but
there are vegetarians out there, so don't offend them by saying meat of the podcast.
This is the paneer of the podcast.
This is the vegetarian-friendly podcast, so yeah, towards the paneer of the podcast. Okay.
I guess this felt unnecessary to me, but you can tell me if I've got this wrong. But there's basically a surge pricing thing, and then there's like a floor thing that this is the base price, this is the surge price.
And we'll keep that for the bad.
Okay.
Because I think it firmly goes to the bad aspect of it. Now, since we're talking about unnecessary and we spoke about the good first, I want to combine both of that into one aspect, which is on the good aspect. And I'm absolutely thrilled about this, which is that finally now Uber and Ola have official permission under this regulatory framework, if it comes into being, that basically private cars can start offering pooled services under Uber and Ola. So this was a concept which has been playing around for quite some time, and the single point of failure of cab aggregators in India is the fact that they cannot increase supply at a very short notice, which is possible in every other country where these companies work. So if you look at the entire model of how Uber and Ola is supposed to function, right, that any person, which is you and I, with who have a car and who knows how to drive, can register on the platform, and with our apps on, we can get, let's say, some alert that around my area, which is BTM layout in Bangalore, there's suddenly a high surge price. So I can just get onto my car, stop doing this podcast, get onto my car, drive down there and get a good fare out of it, right? But it's been banned in India, or this cannot happen in India because there's there's a segregation of license plates, right? The yellow and commercial license plate versus the white or the non-commercial private kind of vehicles. And so therefore, I cannot suddenly turn my private vehicle into a commercial vehicle. Or if I do, then that's fully a commercial vehicle and I can't use it pure for private person. And so on and so forth. There's a lot of restrictions, right? So essentially, the entire surge pricing slash cab aggregation policy, the model of business really does not work in India, because typically when you have a high surge, then it means that, you know, people like you and I will suddenly fill up that void in supply to meet the demand, and therefore the surge drops. That's how it's supposed to take place, but it doesn't. So the one regulation that's come about here, it's not that there's the segregation of commercial and non-commercial is lifted, but at least there, you now you're, you know, given the permission for private cars to do pooling, right? So this is more like the quick ride kind of thing, which they've allowed Uber to do. But I see this at least as a step in the right direction, and hopefully it'll reach at some point towards this thing, right? So if I'm now going on my car, you know, on a fixed route, I can take other passengers along on my car and, you know, go there. So that's a good aspect. It leaves a lot to be desired, but it's an important first step, according to me, right? You need a lot more. Now, within this, they've immediately packed in a completely unnecessary rule, which is that, basically, there's a daily limit, right? That there's only 4 intra-city rides on such cars and 2 weekly intercity rides. So they don't want it to turn into a commercial thing. That they don't want it to turn into something where, as I said, you know, I can use my car for commercial purposes. So, you know, that's the unnecessary or almost, you know, bordering on the bad aspect of it. But yeah, that's a mixed kind of policy rule here.
I think the first one that you talked about really puts the ride sharing in these ride hailing apps, because essentially that's what it is. And I think that's quite fascinating. I agree with you there. There's also this thing, I think it would be remiss if I don't mention it. There's a really big focus on call centers in these guidelines. Basically, there's a 24/7 call center that you have to operate / set up. And I imagine this is for safety of passengers. And I think that's good policy. It strengthens the incumbents, but I imagine for me the trade-off seems to be worth it. I don't know what you have to say.
I would say it's unnecessary, because most of the things that you need a call center for are everything that's related to, you know, usually what you see on Twitter, right? Uber comes out with this promotional ad featuring Virat Kohli, and then everything that all the comments that follow is nothing about Uber, but it says, I took a ride on day before yesterday and the driver didn't come to pick me up. Those kind of things, right? So, but there are features within Uber and Ola to take care of all such customer complaints. So if it is a customer complaint angle, I think the web, they don't need a call center. They have, you know, inbuilt mechanisms within the app to cover all of this. And then, of course, there's Twitter and Facebook where you can also reach out. So, I mean, they don't want to invest in a physical kind of call center with lots of people and telephones, you know, in the traditional way. Yeah. But as long as, you know, consumer complaints are rectified, that's okay. And if not, there's a consumer court. And if there are enough number of cases pending against Uber in the consumer court, then you can think of something like this, right? But I don't see that to be the case at all. Second, in terms of safety, now let's say there is a live situation which requires some form of intervention. I don't think a call center employee is really able to solve this at all, right? What can they do? I mean, they can talk you out of it, perhaps, but you'll probably have to wait, you know, for 10 minutes before you get through with a lot of your call is important to us, so please stay on the line, right? So I don't think that's going to be the way to do this at all. I mean, in fact, I think there is a case for having emergency buttons, but that should go into a 911 kind of, you know, in the US case, 911, but in the Indian case, whatever, 100 police department. That's where action can be taken and some kind of solution can be offered. Not really a call center employee. So you should have better safety functions, emergency buttons, etc. And that should lead you to the police and not really a call center employee.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with you on that call center bit, because I don't know enough about these situations, but the fact that I don't know enough about whether or not a call center can be useful, I mean, I guess it's contextual, but I would, if I am in a fix, I would very much like to have that facility. Yeah, so
If you're in a fix, this is what I'm asking, Rohan. If you're in a fix, would you want to talk to an Uber call center employee and you know the level of agency or the level of authority that a call center employee will have? They will have a fixed set of responses given to them. So if you're in a fix, the last person you want to talk to for help is actually a call center employee. You'd want to talk to someone who has A, authority, and B, some actionable response that they can employ, right? I mean, so that's the police. That's not anyone else but the police.
No, yes, for sure. But for example, like from my personal experience, what I remember when I was supposed to catch a flight from the UK to India, and I lost my passport in the cab. And at that time, a call center would have been a blessing because they would have been able to connect me with the driver. So that's the kind of fix I'm talking about. And
yeah, but also, it's just too few cases and anecdotal data that doesn't justify this kind of... And you don't need a policy for this.
No, I agree. But I also think that you don't appreciate the value of a call center as long as you realize what it can do for you. So like, for example, in this podcast, you mentioned that we'll call 911 or 100 to get to the police, right? But if I am in a fix and things are turning south, and if I don't remember the phone number of the police or the ambulance, then a call center would be precisely what I would go for, because then they'd be able to call those people.
So, okay, fine. But there are technological solutions that, you know, that
yes.
can solve this, where you don't need to remember the number. I mean, a button within Uber app that goes to a call center, the same button can, you know, a same similar kind of button can take you to an emergency, this thing. So you don't need to remember the number.
Yeah.
But anyway, sure. Let's move on from there. Yeah.
Yeah. The one final thing that I thought was extremely unnecessary in this piece of guidelines was, so riders, I'm not quoting verbatim here, but this is the essence of that clause. Riders better follow the route assigned. So you can't like take a longer route. I feel like some guy in Delhi made this. It's like, Bhaiya ji, are you taking me from a longer route so that you charge me more? So that might work in like metro cities from time to time, but in a place that is a tier 2 or tier 3 city, and sometimes roads are just not big enough for a car like Wagonaar to cross. So riders have no choice but to take longer routes. Drivers. So I don't understand why this thing is there, because I mean, and what if they follow longer routes? How is this going to, how is this paragraph on a paper going to change that? It completely blows my mind that this is there. Maybe there's some problem that they're trying to solve that I don't get. But to me, this seems extremely unnecessary.
Yeah, I think it's unnecessary as well. And again, there is a mechanism in Uber itself where if you think the driver has taken a deliberately longer route, then you can actually, you know, you can complain. But even that is unnecessary, because as of now, the you know, there's a predefined kind of route and then a fare, right? So in the route, if that changes, only if it changes by an extreme amount, will the fare kind of change. If not, it's the same. So that's unnecessary. Now let's move on to the bad aspects. And as you can imagine, you know, this is again the government trying to meddle with the market and trying to design the way markets function, which is and will always be a bad idea. So there's a couple of things which you can imagine, and I, you know, I don't want to stress too much upon it, because we've probably done multiple podcasts in the past about surge pricing and about, you know, how pricing should work, etc. So we'll keep it brief. But so one of the things I've done is obviously I put a cap on the surge pricing at 1.5x. So that's the maximum that they can charge. So even under peak demand, there's a cap on surge pricing. Now, we've seen how this has affected certain cities already. So, remember, you know, Bangalore, for instance, has already certain rules regarding surge pricing, and they've banned surge pricing in some sense, not banned it, but sorry, they've allowed it within a narrow band. So they have put a cap on surge pricing. And the effect of that is actually plain to see for a lot of people in Bangalore. So the average waiting time is higher in Bangalore as compared to others. Average number of refusals is higher in Bangalore than other places. And, you know, the average idle time for drivers is also higher in Bangalore than other places. Average earnings is lower in Bangalore than in other places in India itself. So, you know, all of this tells you that you don't really need surge pricing, and surge pricing actually leads to worse outcomes for riders, for drivers, for Uber, and everyone else involved, right? So I think this is, again, I don't want to stress this too much, but the fact that, you know, you need incentives for a driver, right, under extreme circumstances, and Bangalore traffic is notorious, as many of you know. So under peak traffic, I mean, as is in pretty much every other city in India. But in peak traffic, you need to incentivize the driver to, you know, go through that peak traffic in, you know, peak traffic means also high pollution. It also means, you know, longer drive times, which means the number of customers that you can actually service will decrease. So you need to get, you know, more revenue per customer instead of more customers, etc. Right. So I think you should allow the surge pricing for the market to decide the surge pricing. What the government should be concentrating is on providing alternatives to Uber and Ola. I remember the reason why there's a surge pricing for Uber and Ola is because public transport is terrible, right? Because you don't have credible alternatives. You don't have enough buses. You don't have enough metro stops. You don't have enough other forms of transport. And so what the government should be focusing on is providing alternatives such that you don't need surge pricing in the first place, right? So if the, you know, price surges, then I will just choose another alternative. The fact that customers, according to the government, the fact that customers are getting, you know, fleeced or they're having to pay more is because of an ultimate government failure. So I would put this squarely under bad, terrible, ugly policy making.
Beautiful. I mean, can I just add, like, this is more anecdotal than anything, but when the government tries to offer alternatives to, you know, to fix something like surge pricing, I mean, I live in Kanpur and they're trying to come up with a Kanpur metro. But the opportunity cost of that Kanpur metro is that there are no roads in Kanpur anymore because they've dug up the entire city to make this metro. So there are trade-offs. So apart from surge pricing, there's also this very weird division that they've come with. They've said that of the whatever is generated, whatever money is generated from the ride, the driver will get 80%. The state, if it wants, can charge 2%, and the rest can be taken by the aggregator. Yep. Now, the rest is all of combined 18%, which, I mean, Uber and Ola are infamously not profitable. So, and if you are restricting their margin to this 18%, then their ability to scale and their ability to be profitable is, I mean, you're basically restricting that to this barely livable margin is what I imagine. I mean, someone will have to run the numbers on this, but doesn't this seem like a basic hindrance to scale or like a basic hindrance to function?
Absolutely. And the government has absolutely no business in poking its nose into something like this at all. I mean, there are a whole bunch of drivers who are getting a particular fee and who are paying a particular fee to Uber and Ola, and it's a private transaction, right? Again, there is revealed preference here. You ask drivers whether they're happy giving up 30% to Uber. Of course, all of them will say no. But this is a revealed preference, right? A lot of drivers have left driving for private cab companies, have left driving buses or have left driving other things and come on to Uber and Ola because it is the most profitable alternative out there. Right. So that's the revealed preference. And therefore, on average, by the way, it's known that drivers make up to 74% of the rides. That's a statistic. Right. So if drivers thought that 74% was not enough, they can always leave Uber and Ola and go to other trades, driving other things. The fact that they haven't will tell you that there, you know, it seems to be a reasonably good deal. But in any case, it's between the drivers and Uber and Ola for them to figure out, right? Drivers have already, you know, unionized before in the past. They have gone on strikes, etc., fighting the commissions or the fall off in the incentive structures, etc. Now, I'm not saying Uber and Ola is perfect here or, you know, what is the correct percentage, etc. I'm just saying I'm not the right person to decide what is the correct percentage, and definitely the government is not the right entity to decide on what the right percentage is, right? Typically, like exactly like how they should not decide on whether I should pay 10 rupees for a bar of chocolate or 12 rupees for a bar of chocolate. Similarly, they have no business in trying to decide whether Uber should keep 20% of the ride or 30% of the ride, as long as the drivers and the Uber and Ola and the riders are all happy, it's up to them to decide all of these things.
So can I just add, I disagree with you on a couple of points. And the first one is that, about the revealed preferences, I guess drivers joined Uber and Ola because it might have been more profitable at the beginning. I mean, I know in the US, there's a book about Uber. It's a biography called Super Pumped by Mike Isaac from New York Times. And so Uber and Ola give really nice incentives, or used to give really nice incentives for drivers to join them. But those have over time, of course, vanished because it's not sustainable. But I guess there isn't a lot of car riding market out there for people who are not in Uber and Ola. Having said that, I do disagree with this policy, mainly because it's like capping prices in movie theaters, right? Which is, you want to make stuff cheaper for everyone else, but then you have lesser movie theaters. So then you basically ended up achieving the opposite outcome that you wanted. And so if you cap the price to just 18% of the margin for Uber and Ola, it's good for drivers to some extent. But if Uber and Ola can't function on this margin anymore, then the drivers are out of basically what is
exactly right. All of the drivers will end up losing their jobs, and there's about whatever five crore people employed by Uber and Ola. So you don't want that kind of a situation at all where they're out of a job, right? So that's one aspect of it. Now, second, again, this is the unintended consequences, right? Now, what will happen is, okay, you could do this. You could force it upon the cab aggregators. But essentially what they'll do is they can very easily agree on it and then say that we will not then give any incentives. Right? That's how they make it up. Now, they give about 26%, let's say, they keep about 26% per ride and give 74% to the driver. But then they give other forms of incentives, etc., to the drivers. That'll further vanish. I mean, that's fallen a lot since the beginning, of course. But now that'll completely vanish. And then you'll just stick on per ride basis kind of arrangement, which I don't think is better for the driver at all.
Just one final point I want to add here. So that just running the numbers a little bit, if you give 18% to cab aggregators, then the policy has also said that you need term insurance and health insurance for drivers. And then the car also, you need to be accountable for some part of the car. And so basically, not only have you decided that these aggregators are in this 18% margin, you also said that out of this 18% margin, you need to spend X amount on all of this. And like, I would want drivers to have health insurance and term insurance and vehicle insurance. But if this is not sustainable, then they will get none of these things and will also lose the job. So
yeah, that is absolutely overreaching and overstepping and completely, I mean, it will result in this thing, right? You can't see, you're saying Uber can take X amount as commission fees, which means that you're accepting that Uber is nothing but a platform, right? Which just connects drivers and riders. At one point, so you're saying that is the commission fees they can charge. But at the other point, you're saying you have to be liable and accountable to your employees, which means, you know, they're no longer on contract. So there's a fundamental contradiction in their approach to the policymaking within the same policy, right? On one side, you're saying commission fees, which means these are contractors. The drivers are contractors. On the other hand, you're saying that you're liable for their health insurance, for part of their car, etc., which means you're no longer dealing with contractors, but you're dealing with employees and leasing out the vehicles, which is not the case, right? So I think that's just completely muddled policymaking.
Yeah, and even if they were like, I would want this contractor employee situation to change because it doesn't reflect well on the structure of a society, and like, they should have more rights. But I just don't think doing it in a way that basically forces Uber and Ola to close, because I repeat, they're not profitable entities. So giving a bunch of costs, piling them on top of each other is just, I don't know if it's sustainable, and I have serious doubts about it. But yeah.
Okay. So there's just one more on cancellation fee, etc. On, you know, again, it goes into the same thing about the government trying to decide how much should the cancellation fee be. No more than 10% of the total fare and not exceeding 100 rupees, etc. Again, you have no business in any of that. It's between the driver, rider and the cab aggregator. Let them decide. So I'm not even going to comment on this because the logic is the same, that government has no business in this. I want to end with the broadest point that two really broad points. One is that this is wrong timing. This is at a time when the cab aggregators, drivers, etc. are all doing terribly because of reduced demand because of the pandemic. So, you know, you're trying to make massive rule changes now, which means there's going to be increased cost of compliance. There's going to be, you know, more uncertainty in how all of this will pan out, etc. So in terms of timing, I don't think you could have had a worse time to do some of these big rule changes. So that's one thing to consider. And two, good aspect of all of this is still directions or guidelines as given by the union government's Ministry of Transport. So essentially, transport, you know, urban transport and so on is still under the aegis of state governments. So these are guidelines given by the union government, but state governments can choose to adopt which parts of the guidelines, right? I mean, different parts of the guidelines. So you could have a state government which says none of this makes sense and therefore we're not going to adopt it. And I think they can get away with it. I mean, you need a constitutional expert on this, on the federal structure. But I think this is ultimately a state subject. So the union government can only give, you know, model laws or, you know, provide guidelines, and then state governments can decide. So hopefully there will be better sense at the state government level, and two, hopefully there's a lot more commentary and research by people to recommend state governments to take the correct or better approach towards policy making.
All right, on that very wonderful note, thank you so much for listening to All Things Policy. Thanks, Anupam.
Thanks, Ron.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.